I've ordered that and it's on its way, but that's a long pole in the tent. Anyway, very good advice. Thank you very much. I will implement some changes and let you all know. KD2BHM.
On a quick break, John, roughly how many feet of cable do you think you need to go from the handy talkie, your typical operating position, up to the roof? And by the way, you could also, you have the option. Say, for instance, you sometimes use a handy talkie in the living room on the first floor of the house, and sometimes use a handy talkie in the basement. You could have the cable coming down from the roof, have a T connector in the living room, where you open up the T connector, plug in the handy talkie, and you're talking from that position. Reconnect the T connector with one lead coming out of the side that goes nowhere, and that goes to the extra piece of cable to the basement. So now, with that same piece of cable, you have the option of going from the basement or from the living room, if you know what I mean. So, roughly how many feet of cable is required from your typical operating position with a handy talkie up to the roof? And what kind of cable have you considered using? Back to you, John.
Yes, I mean, from the third floor to the roof would be about, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 feet. My current project is to build a roll-up J-pole that is incredibly portable, and the coax lead to that would be maybe 4 or 5 feet, which is very low loss. You can hang it wherever your current operating position is. Ultimately, I'm probably going to want a roof antenna that's a, let's say, you know, a dipole or a, you know, a more permanent installation. But currently, I'm building a J-pole that can be hung inside wherever I am.
You do enough searching on the website. There are some very nice J-pole-like antennas made out of copper tubing, intended for outdoor use. So, if J-pole is your favorite antenna with omnidirectional characteristics, making one that will work outdoors is not very difficult. And ultimately, you may want to put up a Yagi with a rotator, but that's downrange. Sounds like your cables are going to be fairly lost, fairly short in length, and therefore, no matter what other kind of cable you use, it's going to work, even RG58. But I wouldn't use RG58 beyond, let me pick a number, 20 feet. Then it's starting to get a bit lossy. And there are lower loss cables. Okay, we're going to go on to the next person. And that was another John, KC2WGB. I think you said you had a question, John. You got it. What's going on in Staten Island? And thank you for that gift. I'll discuss that with you in a minute, K2RIW. You got it, John, in Staten Island.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. I have two questions from two young hams, two out of the five that I received this week, that maybe you could say a few words if you have time.
Now's the right time for it. Go for it.
Okay, I have a very young ham, Jeff from Long Island City. He wants to know the term solid state, what it means, derivation, and I guess he's not familiar with the warm fuzzy state that we worked with first, so he wanted to know how that came about, and exactly just give him a general description of where we are now with electronics and basically what we had before. So that's the first one, Dick. Over to you.
Very fine, John. In the very early days of radio, everything was spark gap transmitters, spark and arc. And they were very broadband transmitters. And if any one guy was transmitting, everybody else had to be quiet. And then pretty soon they came up with a rig that put out a real specific frequency. And now you can have multiple people on the band simultaneously as long as they're on different frequencies. I'm going to pick a number, roughly 1970. Everything was vacuum tubes. Transmitting tubes, receiving tubes, hollow state. We make a joke and we call it the hollow state. We call it the vacuum state, but real bottled vacuum tubes was the main thing that made transmitters and receivers work up until roughly 1970. In 1948, those three guys at Bell Laboratories, Shockley, Bourdain, and Bertin, came up with this thing called a transistor. And the transistor, in the beginning, these things were flea power, but they had no vacuum tube to them. There was no vacuum required, no glass. It now was this tiny little chunk of germanium or silicon, and that's what solid state means. In other words, transistors, whether they be silicon, whether they be germanium, whether they be field effect, anything, the word solid state really means transistor-like. No vacuum tube, no glass per se. That's my understanding of it. You've been around about as long as I have, John, or exactly as long as I have. You and I were born the same year, I think almost the same month. And so when people say vacuum tube versus solid state, what image does that bring to your mind, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Well, the biggest thing, of course, is in thermionic emission, you've got the heat from the filaments. How the equipment actually degraded over time because of the improper heat and handling, that was one of the major issues with tube devices or thermionic emission valves, as they used to be called. But he was very confused and didn't know, like, it was solid state as opposed to what, liquid state. So, perfect answer, Dick. I think he'll be able to go on from there. He's doing a little reading. He expects to have his ticket, his tech ticket, in 6 months. So right now he's listening to us on a scanner, as is the second one. But good job, Dick.
Okay, go on with your next question, and tell that guy if he's listening with his scanner, as soon as he gets his license, please sign into the TechNet, whether he's got a question or not. And so it's nice to get the feedback. Mel and I used to get quite a number of letters per year with people who said, gee, I was turning around with my scanner. I heard this thing called the Technical Net. I heard a bunch of guys having a lot of fun. I decided to join them. I went out and got my license, and here I am. And you guys caused it. We got a few of those letters per year, and it gave us a warm, fuzzy feeling. Go ahead with your next one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, this comes from a young man in Staten Island, Larry. I don't know him, but he's here. He's questioning the use of he intends to get a 50-watt combination mobile rig and use it in his base. Okay, he wants to use the same antenna, which is a mag mount, in the home. He's worried about two things. He's going to have it approximately 15 feet above him, which will be in his attic. Below, he's got his little operating area. He's worried about fire in the attic from the 50 watts, and he wants to know if it will work, and how should he mount the antenna in the attic. Just give him a few pointers on that, and he expects to get his radio in 2 months.
Yeah, the nice thing about using a mobile rig is that you can plug it into the car, unplug it from the car, bring it into the house, plug it into a 12-volt power supply, and continue operating with the same rig. And by having an antenna installed in the house that you plug in to the rig, and then unplug and plug that antenna connector of the rig back into the automobile is one approach. Or, in the beginning, the mag mount antenna, you either stick to the car, or you unstick it from the car and bring it into the house. That's another approach. If the mag mount antenna, let me drop. If the mag mount antenna is a quarter wave type, it really means that it ordinarily uses the great big chunk of sheet metal of the car as the counterpoise. Counterpoise is a fancy word for the grounded terminal of the antenna. The antenna has to push some electrons into the antenna, and it's got to pull them out of something. Well, in the case of sticking it on the automobile, it's pulling those electrons out of the steel of the automobile and plugging them into the antenna on the first half cycle, and on the second half of that cycle, it takes them from the antenna and plugs them back into the steel of the car. So it's got to have a good-sized piece of metal to work well. That's if it's a quarter-wave type. And so, therefore, when you take that mag mount and you bring it into the car, into the house, it'd be nice if you're sticking it to a substantial piece of metal. The side of an air conditioner is probably enough. The side of a refrigerator is enough. The side of an old-fashioned iron radiator, a steam-type radiator, is more than enough. If you put it on a piece of metal that's only 6 inches square, that's not enough. It's not that the antenna will fail. It just won't work as well. You'll end up with some extra standing wave ratio, which is less than desirable way of using the antenna. It's not going to explode. Nothing bad's going to happen. But to put it on a big enough sheet of metal is your first criteria when you're using a mag mount normally. Let me drop. Now, the other part of your question was, if I was using a 50-watt transmitter into an antenna, And if I'm a Boy Scout and I forgot my matches and I'm trying to start a fire with that antenna, wow, would that be difficult? If I took every bit of my knowledge and I realized that the highest voltage on the antenna is right at the tippy top of the antenna, and if I put a sharp little needle right at the tippy top of the antenna, and if I put a great big piece of metal a 32nd of an inch or a 64th of an inch away from that needle, where I just barely drew a tiny little bit of a spark when the transmitter is transmitting, and if I got some very dry straw that I put right at the tip of that needle, in between the needle and the chunk of steel, and so across that arc I'm now trying to light that very dry piece of straw or a piece of paper. If I tried doing that, if I intentionally tried starting a fire with 50 watts into a quarter wave ground plane mag mount antenna, I won't say it's impossible, but you better have a lot of time on that battery. You better have a lot of patience. It's hard. So the chances of you inadvertently starting a fire in the attic with 50 watts, I give you one chance in 1,000 that if you tried real hard, you're going to do that. If you're running a kilowatt, it's easier. 50 watts, I doubt it. You might have another opinion on that one, John. KC2WGB. Those guys in Staten Island, they got some pretty good ideas from time to time. K2RIW. You got it, John.
Well, Dick, I agree with you. I think that starting a fire with 50 watts and a proper antenna would be difficult. I also would think that he could maybe take his mom's baking pan, turn that upside down and stick it on there, or maybe a garbage can cover if he had a metal one, which is hard to find today. But any large area like that, I think, should be sufficient. And just simply put it on a table. I think that Larry would do well with that. And I don't think there's a radiation hazard at 15 feet away with 50 watts, which is something else he was worried about, which I didn't mention.
Yeah, Wesley recognized. And the cooking sheet, the cookie sheet would probably be a big enough chunk of steel. The metal cover from a garbage can would probably be a big enough. So, now when it comes to RF radio frequency biohazard with 50 watts, you study what happens with a quarter wave ground plane antenna, and the usual standard nowadays is around 1 or 2 milliwatts per square centimeter. You'd have to be approximately 2 feet away from the antenna, with the transmitter running key down, continuous power output for 6 solid minutes, with you staring into the antenna with your eyes open for 6 minutes. You do all of that that I just described, you would be at the threshold of alarm of the current American standard for radio frequency biohazard. 2 feet, 6 minutes, and 50 watts. Rough numbers. You make it 5 feet or further away, you make the transmission intermittent from time to time, you turn your head the other way and you close your eyes. All of these things are making it more and more safe. The most vulnerable part of a human being is the cornea of the eye. The heating of your cornea with radio energy, if you're real close to the antenna, and because the cornea has a 6-minute time constant, that's where that American standard comes from. 6 minutes and a couple of milliwatts per square centimeter. And so you calculate how much area there is in a sphere that's 2 feet in radius and so on. You'll see how the power is being spread out in all directions, and the really watts per square centimeter starts going down real fast. That's why it becomes safe. So the eye with a 6-minute time constant is the reason why the American standard is how much power you subject the human eye to for a 6-minute period in order to make a judgment as to whether or not it's
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
So it's a 6-minute time period that you have to judge. You could transmit a hell of a lot of power, and if you're only doing it for 30 seconds at a time, it would be safe, even though common sense would lead you differently, because that's just the way the human body works. N2XJN, with your comment, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
N2XJN. You said 50 watts is not going to treat a fire. I just came back to the radio, so I didn't hear all of the discussion, but I can bet you they create a fire within watts. If you tune the antenna to capacitive instead of inductive character, then within watts, you are able to create from the antenna to nearby beam a nice spark. And then, because of the spark in nature, you may create a fire. Enter a gene.
Yeah, what I was saying in the portion that maybe you didn't hear is that if I'm a Boy Scout, and I forgot to bring... By the way, if you're hearing disruptive signals during our TechNet, periodically press the reverse button on your rig and listen to the input and find out how strong the signal is and report it to the interference committee at AR or at LIMARC.org. If I'm a Boy Scout, forgot my matches, and I've got to make a fire with a 50-watt transmitter, it would be difficult. Yeah, there are ways that you can redesign the antenna, and you can make thermal energy and catch something on fire. But under ordinary circumstances, a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, I know that the highest voltage is at the tip of the antenna. I put a sharp needle there. I bring a piece of steel nearby. I'm drawing this very tiny little spark, and I now put a very dry straw or paper in that area, and I try to catch it on fire. I'd have to really work at it. It would be difficult.
How about loop antenna?
Same thing with a loop antenna. To draw a spark with enough energy to catch something on fire, like straw or paper. Have you actually really caught paper on fire with your loop antenna? Have you really done that, Wes? Over to you, Wesley.
No, I don't. But how about no antenna at all? You just make the output of the transmitter very much capacitive in nature. That would create a huge voltage on it, on the output, and you would have a very nice spark on it. And to actually, Tom and Dick.
Yeah, John, in a second. When you take a 50-ohm coax cable coming out of a transmitter, assuming the transmitter really is a 50-ohm source, there's a catch there. If the transmitter really is a 50-ohm source and it normally operates into a 50-ohm load, and whatever number of watts you're transmitting, you can easily calculate how many volts is on that coaxial cable. If I now simply open circuit the cable, remove the 50-ohm load, and open circuit it, common sense would lead you to believe the voltage is going to go to infinity. It does not do that. If I really have a 50-ohm source of signal, when I go from 50-ohm load to infinite load, the voltage on that semiconductor of the cable doubles. That's all. It goes to twice normal voltage if it's a 60-ohm source. If it's a 50-ohm source, is what I'm trying to say. I will admit that our transmitters are a nearly constant current generator. Therefore, if there was a magic length of the cable, I could get a higher voltage. But now, it takes a double or a triple error to get that higher voltage.
Add capacitor into it, remove the coaxial cable, you have a voltage.
No matter what size capacitor I put there, the lowest capacitor in the world is a pure open circuit. As I make the capacitor larger and larger, by the way, a pure open circuit on a pure 50-ohm signal generator, you get twice normal voltage, no more. Now, as I make that capacitor go from 0 picofarads, that's a pure open circuit, and I start making the capacitor larger and larger, the voltage at that point, that's 2-to-1 higher, the voltage goes down. So putting a capacitor on the end of a cable is not going to give you a high voltage, even though you may think it does. You might have a comment on that, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Switch to the output and try to find the location of the cockroach.
Yeah, we've been listening. So what you've used is good common sense, Wes, but it's not quite that bad.
Yeah, well, Dick, let me interrupt you for a moment. Okay, remember we have had a discussion, how come we could have a thousands of volts on the output of the transmitter or generator. The TNC Power Conversion Incorporated made AG0201 1HV, high voltage. The generator works from 100 kHz to 500 kHz, delivering approximately 1500 volts on it. But I can, I had it on a bench with John, and he was terrified what I was doing with that voltage. Now, another one is the monster, which is the Fluke, and the model number is 5205A. I can do similar things with that, although the voltage maximum by manufacturer spec is 1200 volts. I wonder if you could explain better to me this, because there is something that I might not really understand. Back to you.
If I make a very specific circuit designed for giving me high voltage, a Tesla coil is one of them. A Ford Spark coil is another one. If I make a very specific circuit with very small amounts of power, I can get very brief sparks that are very high in voltage. But an ordinary 50-ohm transmitter going into an ordinary 50-ohm antenna, very unlikely for that to do it. It's not specifically designed to do it. And now you're asking another series of questions, which we're going to get into in the later section of the SECnet. Now, John, I know you wanted to probably go to the very next one.
One more thing. 13.8 megahertz is usually used for the frequency to drive the lasers and modern lasers. No, I'm not talking about the diode lasers. And they have extreme voltage on it and extreme power on it. I'm trying to understand the difference. It's an RF power, but the voltage is high on the output. Back to you.
There's nothing magic about 13.56 or 13.6 megahertz. Nothing magic about the frequency. If I've got the right kind of circuitry, like a Tesla coil, like a Ford Spark coil, like many other kinds of Marx generator, Cockwalton generator, Wimshurst machine, Van de Graaff generator, there are many kinds of circuits that are specifically designed at whatever frequency you like, with the right kind of a design, I can give you an extremely high voltage. That's a very specific circuit designed to do that. A 50-ohm transmitter a ham radio operator uses, until he adds that very exotic circuitry, he's not going to get the high voltage, he's not going to get a fire, he's not going to get biohazard. It's easy to look at the vocabulary, radio frequency biohazard, radio frequency energy, and think of radio frequency radiation. You look at those words, you can easily be alarmed by the vocabulary in the words. 90-some-odd% of the time, this is an excessive alarm, not required. It's a misunderstanding. So I think this guy should go and build that transmitter, use his mag mount antenna wherever he wants to. It's going to work like a charm, and he'll enjoy it. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, I want to make sure we weren't scaring Larry, because that question he asked, and I prefaced it with a proper antenna. So, you know, Wesley's bringing up points that really don't have anything to do with him. As long as he doesn't have any flammable material, you know, within 3 feet of that antenna, I think he'll be fine. I don't think he should even worry about it. Yeah, some of the things Wesley says is true, but they don't apply here. And he had mentioned about me being frightened when he was working with a power supply here. Well, he's damn right. He was doing unsafe practices. I do not like that. I don't condone it. And, you know, he says he's been doing it all his life, but you're only allowed to make X amount of mistakes, and then you're going to get hit. So I just want Larry to feel comfortable, and thank you. That's about all I have from Mel's Corner here today on this basis. So out of the five questions, these were the only two that were really basic for young hams. The other ones were really erudite things. Back to you, Dick.
Dick, I would like to make a comment about the safety issues.
That's very good that you call it Mel's Corner. That's a very good name for it, John. Did you come up with that? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, you and I spoke about that last week. We came up with that sort of together. It would be nice if maybe Limar could make that the address for the stuff. Knowing memory of Mel, he put a lot of effort in for us. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, now we do have another guy who signed in, both Gary and Bernie. Gary was the next guy, KB2JXM. Go ahead with your question, Gary. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Gary's not there, and the next guy was Bernie, Kilo 2 Mike Uniform. Bernie, go ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Am I making the repeater okay?
You're making the repeater very well. Tiny bit of noise, but you sound good. Go right ahead, Bernie.
Okay, great. My question is, I have my little Yaesu VX3 handheld with the extended coverage that doesn't have sideband. So I ordered a little Tentec BFO kit that makes a 455 kilohertz or so signal to mix in with the IF, and it works very well. And I'm picking up lower, you know, all the sideband, and it's a lot of fun. My question is, the way the circuit is designed, you have the adjustment of a little CAN inductor, and then you have a potentiometer to adjust the frequency. And the spread on that potentiometer is very slight. So when you tune sideband, you barely touch that that dial. My question is, what, if anything, could I add to that circuit to spread out the tuning on that potentiometer?
Been there and done that one, Bernie. Any potentiometer, you can give it extra resolution by making the voltage drop across the potentiometer smaller. Let's assume now that your potentiometer is wired directly to the power supply of that BFO, beat frequency oscillator, and the potentiometer has the full 10 volts across it. So as you rotate that knob, the center conductor goes from 0 to 10 volts in my example. And if when that potentiometer is adjusted to the position where you're very close to getting the right kind of tuning to listen to that single sideband signal, and you make a measurement of how many volts is there on the slider of the potentiometer. You put your voltmeter in there, open up the case, put your voltmeter on the slider, and you measure the voltage to ground, and in my example, you come out with 5 volts. Now, if you put an extra resistor from the top of the potentiometer up to its power supply, and another resistor from the bottom of the potentiometer to ground, you now can make a 3-resistor voltage divider network. You select the right upper resistor and the right lower resistor. You'll be setting the range, and you can easily adjust it in such a way that now instead of 10 volts across the potentiometer, there's only 1 volt across it. The bottom of the potentiometer now, in my example, has 4.5 volts, and the top of the potentiometer has 5.5 volts. So as you slide the potentiometer, you're sliding from 4.5 to 5.5, and in the example I just gave, you now have 10 to 1 more resolution. So by putting resistors above and below the potentiometer is one way of doing it. Putting resistors in series with the slider and making a voltage divider network is another way. So by the proper way of adding extra resistors, you can both make it...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
By adding extra resistors, you can increase the voltage divider network function so that now that potentiometer has a lot more resolution. It's going to have smaller range. So that's the trade-off. Whenever you give a potentiometer more resolution, in other words, it doesn't tune so sharply, the good news is now it's a lot easier to tune. The bad news is if you don't do it just right, you run out of range and you're always using it at one end or the other end. But by properly adjusting those resistors, you can do that. So if you study the right website and you just Google the word voltage divider, resistor voltage divider network, guarantee you're going to find some articles on it. Guarantee there's a chapter approaching this in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and many other good electronic manuals should help you on this one. And if not, if you don't find it, come back, tell us about your circuit. When you look at the schematic diagram and analyze the circuit around that potentiometer, and you come back next week and describe that to us, we'll help you select those resistors if need be, Bernie. You've got a nice, easy solution to your difficult-sounding problem. K2 Mike Uniform, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW to K2MU. Perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to know. I knew there must be a way to do it. I mean, that's not being an engineer. Appreciate the information. Exactly what I needed to know. What I'm going to do is take some measurements and just see exactly what the voltage range is. And then I can play around and see what I got in the junk box and see what it does. But I'll have fun with that. I had a lot of fun with this little circuit. I'll tell you, it was the first little circuit I've built in a while. And just to pick up that little 455 signal and hear the sideband coming in on this little radio, you know, old-fashioned radio stuff, a lot of fun. So I appreciate that very much, Dick, and I will definitely let you know how it goes. K2RIW in the TechNet, K2MU.
Well, I ran into the problem you're running into right now, Bernie, head on. Let me think. The year was in the late 70s. I was put on a spectrum analyzer development program that was going on at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. They had a breadboard of the working spectrum analyzer on the table. It had five different bands to it. As you switched to each one of the bands to make things work correctly, you had to very carefully adjust a 10-turn potentiometer, very carefully, because they had no resolution on those potentiometers. And when you got it set just right and the machine was working, all you'd have to do is drop a screwdriver on the table. The vibration that the screwdriver made shook the potentiometer, and it went out of alignment. They had it set that sensitive. And they thought that was a good working model of a breadboard circuit that they were handing us to us to go into production. My goodness, would that have been a disaster? I spent the next couple of weeks very carefully setting resistors around every one of those potentiometers. I think there's about 10 or 12 of them altogether. Very carefully selecting those resistors so that now the potentiometers had some real resolution, and you stood a chance of both adjusting it without using a magnifying glass and turning a 10-turn pot to the nearest 1 degree, which was crazy, and also having it hold its setting under the real world of vibration. So that's where I cut my teeth and became a little bit famous for making this very hairy circuit into a much more usable one. And eventually it became something that was manufactured, and they built quite a few thousand of them. You'll be very happy with that. By the way, let me give you one other piece of information. Back in the days when people would add a beat frequency oscillator, or back in the days when a radio like a Heathkit AR3 had a beat frequency oscillator built in, and for Morse code reception, that worked pretty well. For single sideband reception, you needed a little bit more dynamic range linearity. In fact, in order to make a single sideband signal sound correct, you had to not only tune the radio to the right receiver frequency, tune the BFO to the right frequency, but you had to also lower the RF gain control on the circuit, the front end RF gain of the receiver, so that a strong single sideband signal didn't give you a lot of distortion. So if your radio doesn't have an RF gain control, you may run into the problem that a strong single sideband signal will give you a kind of distortion. The more modern receivers that are made for single sideband reception have something built in called a product detector, which works quite a bit better than a simple detector plus beat frequency oscillator, and that problem has gone away. The automatic gain control automatically controls all that. But back in the days of BFOs, that's something you have to know about, and you've probably already done a little bit of experimenting along those lines. I wonder if your radio does have an RF gain control, Bernie. Kilo 2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, it doesn't. My radio doesn't have an RF gain control, but I found the BFO to put out a nice strong signal. I just take the leads from the BFO, and wrap them around the receiver a little bit, you know, right around the HT. And there's a nice strong frequency, and sideband comes in beautiful, just absolutely beautifully, no problem at all, except for, yeah, you have to, you know, tune that that potentiometer, you know, you just have to touch it just right to get, you know, the frequency, so I realize there'll be less of a range if I add those resistors, but it'll be nice to have a, you know, to really be able to pitch of the voice and not have to have a hair trigger on that. But no, as far as RF gain and any problem with picking up the sideband, no, it's really a pleasure. It's really cool. It's like discovering discovering ice for the first time or whatever. I mean, it's an old trick, but it's still pretty cool.
Pretty fine, Bernie. Sounds like you're having some fun. And to homebrew things like that and then make them work better and better gives you quite a bit of pleasure. Come back next week and let us know how that project is going. One more call to Gary, KB2 Juliet X-ray Mike, if you're there, Gary, K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think he got called away. And I think Ed, K2GJE, gave us a comment. I don't think he wanted to be added to the list. Let me make a standby just to be sure.
Negative.
Very fine, Ed. Okay, Paul, you said you had a space report, and now's the time for the space report. WS2N, our space expert. What's NASA been doing? And I went through the mathematics, by the way, of where you told me, I think it's 116 astronomical units is where the Voyager is, and you're absolutely right. That's something like 8.3 hours, I think it is, or was it 16 hours one way at the speed of light for the signal to go out there, and then when the satellite talks back to you, I think it's 32 hours round trip altogether. Oh boy, that thing is really out there, way out, as they say, out of this world. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, looking back at, I think last week, 12 and a half hours, I think I came up with. One way, that's the latest. And I think 100, yeah, it was, well, let's see, Pluto was 39, called 40. So, yeah, 120 some odd AU, I think it is. So, yeah, called 12 and a half. Yeah, if you do the math, you know, 186,000 miles per second. Yeah, that's amazing per second. And here this thing is 12 and a half hours. Just one direction. Another, well, 24-hour turnaround period. Wow. Yeah, just two topics on the space part of that. I didn't have much. I was going to combine it, like, with next week. But I guess the big news for NASA, if you want to consider it big, it's very different, is the spacecraft Dragon, they call it Dragon, and it's a rocket called the Falcon, will be launched in February to the International Space Station. First time a commercial company will be supplying the International Space Station with supplies. You have a company called SpaceX, and this is a company that was developed by the owner of PayPal. It's got his name. But guy that put together PayPal on the internet has this company putting together the Dragon spacecraft. This thing's been launched before last year. Let me drop it. And it was put into orbit for about 3 or 4 hours, did some maneuvers, and then it actually came back to Earth and landed in the Pacific Ocean. And they brought it back. The same is going to hold true for this. It's been approved by NASA. It's going to go up to the International Space Station. It's not going to really dock, per se, with the space station. They're going to have a robotic arm come out and grab a hold of it. And then at that point, it will pull it into a bay, a docking port, and they'll unload the payload. It's quite large. It's twice the a little over twice the amount of payload in the Dragon than what the Progress Russian spacecraft bring up. They bring up about 6,000. This thing is around 13,000 pounds worth of payload. So it's a pretty big deal. We don't have anything being launched from the United States at this time. Let me drop it. Right now, the resupply vehicles are the H-2 by Japan. The Progress spacecraft from Russia. And they have the ATV, which is capable of doing about one or two a year by the Ariane 5 rockets. That comes out of the European Space Agency. And so, that, you know, now this thing here, this Dragon, they call it the Dragon spacecraft, is going to go up, dock with the space station, and then undock and actually come back to Earth, land in the Pacific Ocean. If you look at the other spacecraft, the ATVs, the Progress, the H-2, those burn up over the Pacific. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Mine is designed to come back, and eventually they want to put retro rockets on it, actually have it land on, you know, on the on ground instead of the ocean. They do have future plans of having them manned, maybe 3 or 4 years out. Up to 7 astronauts on board would be able to go up to the space station. I think that's optimistic, but that's what they say. Maybe three or four years out. I wish that was true, but I don't know how they're going to do it. I mean, I guess it's possible. That's the commercial part of this whole deal. So I thought I'd bring that up, as well as the Curiosity mission that's still doing good. Let me drop it. And that's on the way to Mars. Should be there early August of 2012, next year. Just wanted to bring that up because there was something that came up by the ARRL. They put out some kind of a statement that there was amateurs involved from Germany that was able to hear this thing coming back on 10 gig. They heard it when it was about 70,000 miles out, and I don't think it was too advertised. I mean, the one that was using a 20 meter dish, parabolic dish in Germany, which is normally used for presently anyway for receiving the signals from the stereo spacecraft, the A and B. There's two spacecraft that are going around the sun right now, opposite from one another. And right now this is involved in receiving that signal. This amateur radio operator in Germany converted it over temporarily and pointed it towards the Curiosity spacecraft. Was able to pick up signals from that spacecraft. So I thought I'd bring it up. I mean, it doesn't sound like every ham was able to do this, but somebody out there did. That's pretty much it, Dick. Back to that WS2S. WH-1-1-1.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question in general that has to do with this topic of space. Is that permitted?
We're on the subject of space. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay. This is probably directed more towards you directly. I don't know if you heard recently, I don't know how old this discovery is, but apparently they discovered a planet in the Kepler system, something like 600 light years away, and they're calling this planet that's rotating around the sun apparently B22b or something like that. Now, the question I had is they said they measured the temperature on this planet, and apparently it's something like 71.6 degrees as far as they can tell. How is that done from this kind of distance? Back to you, Dick.
Did you hear about it, Dick? I did.
Yeah, I'm going to give him a couple of speculations, and I'm going to pass it over to you, Paul, to give you the finer answer. Kepler, by the way, is not the name of the system. It's the name of the spacecraft that NASA launched. The Kepler Space Telescope is looking at something like 110 or 150,000 stars simultaneously. And if any one of those stars winks by the slightest amount because of a planet that passes in front of it, you now can make a measurement by the amount of wink tells you the size of the planet, the timing tells you how far away it is, and the brightness of the star, and its redshift. In other words, every star puts out a spectrum. In other words, every star contains some hydrogen, some helium, some iron, and some lithium and whatever, a whole bunch of individual elements. Each one of these elements that are either in the star or being synthesized by the star puts out a very specific wavelength. When those electrons jump from the higher orbit to the lower orbit of that particular atom of, let's say, hydrogen, it puts out an extremely specific wavelength. So you look at these individual emission lines, whether they be lines of absorption or lines of emission from the sun, from the star, that plus the Kepler constant allows you to figure out the range. So with reasonably high precision, you know the range of the star. By looking at the total amount of light that star is giving you, you know its diameter. By knowing its range and knowing its brightness and knowing its signature, you now know how big a sun it is, so to speak. By knowing the timing of the satellite that's passing in front of it, the planet that's passing in front of it, you know the orbital distance. You know whether or not that planet is at the orbit of Mercury or at the orbit of Jupiter or at the orbit of Pluto, if you know what I mean. Let me drop.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
See, it's not putting this all together. You know the brightness of the star. You know the range of the star. You know the range of the planet. You therefore can easily calculate what is the temperature the planet will eventually settle at. The planet may have started off a lot hotter. Our Earth, for instance, in the very beginning, had a whole lot of material coming together. We had a whole lot of volcanoes and whatever. It was a real hot planet in the beginning. And it slowly cooled. And it cooled to a reasonably stable temperature compared to the range we are from the sun. We're in the Goldilocks zone. We're not too close like Mercury, where it would be too hot. We're not too far like Pluto, where it would be too cold. So you put it all together, you can see, you can make a pretty darn good guess within a small number of degrees of Fahrenheit of what is the temperature of that planet. Therefore, assuming now that that planet has water on it, and we have reason to believe that the comets are always depositing water on planets as they hit, most likely it is liquid water, most likely it's got the water, most likely it's got the right temperature. By the knowing the size of the star, you know, the spectral signature it gives you, you can tell whether or not that star is 5 billion years into its life. Our sun is going to last roughly 10 billion years. We're 5 billion years into its life, and we can find that all by looking at the spectral signature of the elements that are being synthesized in that star. Step by step, you can see how it all comes together. Joe, let's see what Paul's got to say about this. WS2N. What do you know about this particular Goldilocks planet that Kepler has discovered? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Joe's probably heard about it anyway. It's about twice the size, a little bit bigger than twice the size of Earth. A little closer in to the orbit of the sun, of its sun. But the reason they come up with the Goldilocks zone, even so it's closer, is because the sun is not as hot as ours. It's not as bright as ours. So it's closer in, but it comes up to about the same temperature as we are here. And it also has a 240-day period there, you know, orbital period. So that's pretty good. Kepler's coming up with more and more of this, and that's the goal, is to try to find the planets that are taking about a year to go around, you know, an Earth year, and it's doing it quite well. They are up to about 2,000, a little over 2,000 count for the Kepler, which is inside of a year, quadruple the amount that they knew about one or 2 years ago. They've got another year left for the mission. Let me drop it. And it's already talk of extending that mission beyond that year. So. The latest is that they think that
Oh, through extrapolation, there's probably 500,000 planets in the Goldilocks zone throughout our galaxy alone. So that's the latest. So, all we need is another deal that we had years ago before they did away with it. 1992, they did away with the listening portion supplied by the government. Government money was cut, and we need to listen to all these different planets now and find out if anybody's there. Dick, back to you.
Question, Dick.
As soon as I make another comment, I'm going to pass it over to John and then Joe in that order. A very good question you asked, Joe. Now, the fact that that star is smaller than our sun means it's putting out less light. The fact that the planet is closer means that it's getting more light, and therefore it's a nice balance of the Goldilocks zone. Common sense would lead you to believe that a bigger star has more material, more mass, and you know that the star is burning up mass, turning it into energy. That's where the light's coming from. So a bigger star, by common sense, should last longer. Absolutely, positively, the opposite of common sense. A bigger star has more material, which means there's a stronger gravitational force in the center, which means the nuclear fire in the center is more violent. So these supergiant stars that are out there that we can see burn themselves out in 10,000 years, a wink of the eye, so to speak. Our particular size sun is stable for roughly 10 billion years. A smaller star will be stable for even a longer period of time. That particular star maybe is going to be stable for 20, 30 billion years. So that means that particular Goldilocks planet has a much longer time period in which it can create life if it wants to. The higher probability that life is going to be there. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Question for Paul, Dick. Was it 6 million light years in distance from us? Or 600 million, like Joe said. That sounds too far for me. What did you hear, Paul?
You got it, Paul.
600 million, no, that would be way outside of our galaxy. I think Andromeda is, what, 2-3 million, I think 2 million light years away. That's the next biggest galaxy, similar to ours. There's a couple of other ones. A little closer, but that's 2 million light years out. This thing was, I think, 600. I think it was 600 years, 600 light years away. The Orion Nebula is what, 1500, so you know, half that distance. The Orion Nebula, of course, is within our galaxy. The whole galaxy. Something like 150,000 years, light years across. So, I think that gives you an idea of the perspective of what we're talking about, John.
The closest star that we know of, Alpha Centauri, Alpha Proxima Centauri, 4 and a fraction light years away, is the closest star. Our galaxy is approximately 150,000 light years in diameter. And each one of the galaxies that are in our local galactic group are numbers like 2 billion. Correction, 2 million. 2 million light years. So 2 million light years is one of the major galaxies in our local galactic group, 2 million light years away. We're 150,000 light years in diameter. And this particular star that Kepler found for us, the Kepler Space Telescope, found is 600 light years away. So it's fairly close. A long distance if you had to travel there. At the speed of light, it would take 600 years to get there. You and I are not likely to do that. Your grandchildren are not likely to do that. But sending radio signals, yeah, that's possible. And as we build bigger and bigger radio telescopes, listening to these signals is within the realm of possibility. So with that many Goldilocks planets, let me drop for a second. Back in the days when Mr. Drake, roughly 1948 or so, came up with the Drake equation, where you plug in a whole bunch of variables and you try to calculate what's the probability of finding life somewhere else? And we used to think that planets were very rare, that a planetary system like ours was, in those days, speculated to be one in a million chance. But even that would have still been a lot of life, because you got 10 to the 22 stars in this particular galaxy. Correction, 10 to the 12. 10 to the 12 stars in this galaxy, 10 to the 20, 10 to the 12, or 10 to the 11 observable galaxies, 10 to the 22 stars altogether. So you got 10 to the 11 stars. If one in a million, which is 10 to the 6, was the chances of getting planets like ours, you still have 10 to the 5 out of 1,000 stars out there with planets like ours. We're slowly discovering that every single star has got planets, with rare exception. And so now it's not how many stars have got planets, it's how many stars have got planets where one of the planets is in the Goldilocks zone. So the numbers have suddenly, in the last few years, really gone strong in the direction of life as we see it. I'm convinced, Joe, there's a lot of life out there. Getting to it, hearing them, I'll admit that's not easy, but there's a lot of life out there. You'd like to think that we're unique and we've been given special consideration. I doubt it. I think we're just one of very many. We haven't been given any special consideration that I know of. WHYY, KQRIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
I agree with you. There's probably many, many places out there that are, you know, probably capable of possibly sustaining life. And if some smart K2REW out there invents warp drive in the next 2 weeks, maybe you can go there by Christmas. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this warp drive makes some nice science fiction. And lots of people have been listening to Einstein, who basically says you cannot exceed the speed of light. But all of a sudden, CERN does this experiment that's a reproduction of what the Fermilab did. And we're finding that these neutrinos move a little bit faster than the speed of light. Reminds me like the early days of when you found superconductivity. In the very early days, you found superconductivity when you went down to something like 2 degrees above absolute zero. And as they started studying materials more and more, all of a sudden they found some materials where it can be 100 degrees above absolute zero in the Celsius scale and have superconductivity. So, the fact that we've seen a little bit of edge of something that's better, these neutrinos moving faster, gives some people hope that there is a way of exceeding the speed of light. Maybe only neutrinos can do it. Neutrinos have essentially no mass and essentially no charge, so maybe it's not useful information. But don't give up. There's a lot more unknown than there is known. There's a lot to be learned. You live in an exciting time. A buddy of mine was talking about the great days of when they converted from spark and arc transmitters over to sine wave transmitters. And what an exciting time that was. We have a lot more exciting times. Let me drop. We have a lot more exciting times now. The things that people are putting in their pocket as a Wi-Fi radio, as a iPod, iPad, computer, digital assistant, whatever you want to call it. We've come a long way. You ain't seen nothing yet. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K1FC.
K1FC. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, on the neutrinos, the problem is that astronomical observations where bursts of light have been matched up with the neutrino flux. They're far enough away that there should be, in one case, 4 years different, and there wasn't, so they came pretty much together. And also, theoretically, if they were faster than light, they should have lost energy, and they didn't. So right now, they're still scratching their heads. There are a number of proposals as to why they got this strange result, but I think it'll eventually be resolved that there is... it's got to go down with Q waves or something. Thank you, Dick. Came with us, please.
Yeah, good stuff, Fred. At first, they thought, well, there's an error in the way they set the clocks because there were using geo-positioning satellites as a way of setting the clocks. They thought there was an error in the positioning of the two locations. They resolved the positions to the nearest few feet. They resolved the clocks by shipping a clock from one location to the other.